You're listening to Radio Aryan at RadioAryan.com.
Hello, and welcome to Truthful Out Radio. Today's date is Friday, the 16th of March, 2018. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, broadcasting at RadioAryan.com. As it's Truthful Out Radio, we have the man behind Truthful Out Films, Adolf Hitler, The Greatest Story Never Told, Communism by the Back Door, and his new one, The Freemasonic Victory of World War II, Mr. Dennis Wise. Dennis, how are you doing tonight?
I'm okay, thanks. Yeah, I think we've fallen on a decent subject again.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. I've had the privilege of being able to watch the first few minutes of the new episode, and it does look very interesting subject matter. The Versailles Peace Treaty and all the Jews that were involved in it. Do you want to let the listeners know or let them in for what the plan is for the next episode and what it is that you're hoping to show with it, Dennis?
Yeah, well, basically what it is, the whole series is aimed at showing people that this British Empire was a combination of the British elite and the Jews taking over a series of time. And so consequently, you know, all these, I suppose, wars with the British Empire was a kind of a way of the Jews taking over the world, which was always their intention, according to the protocols, without even being suspected as being at war.
Well, yeah, they get the rest of the Gentile nations. We were the ones that went to war, and then it would come to treaty time, and our leaders would go there, but it wasn't actually our leaders that were hashing out the details of the treaties. Yeah, it was all these Jews. I've been listening to Ted Midler's excellent series on Henry Ford's The International Jew. And in that, it was before World War II, but World War I had happened. And in that, he was talking about how during the war, every nation had a Jew that was responsible for right up the top of the government, whether they were responsible for war requisitions or ministry for war or a foreign secretary. All of them had Jews in this position. And then at the end of the war, all these Jews were sent out as the envoys of the different countries. So it may have said, oh, well, we've got French there, we've got a German representative, we've got a British representative. Every single one of them were Jews. So it was basically a big group of Jews working out what was best for the Jews. And this wasn't the only time it had happened. You know, I mean, leading right up till the First War, All the European nations had Jews doing all the negotiating.
Yeah, well, I suppose history will take it as the leaders went with the Jewish advisors, but in fact, that wasn't the case. It was the Jews going with the puppets.
Yeah, it was completely the other way around. Of course, that's what they'll say. They say, oh, we wanted to have my best advisor here. And of course, the advisor's the Jew. But the Jew is doing what's best for the Jews.
Yeah, under the cover of these allied leaders and puppets. I mean, Woodrow Wilson was a puppet. In fact, further on down the line, Roosevelt was a puppet. So, consequently, nothing changed.
Well, moving back to the video, the first part of the video, you talk about the Pope. Now, you would think with a peace conference, you would think that we would want to have a neutral representative, shall we say, a neutral representative for Europe. Well, Europe are Christian nations. How about the head of the church? How about we have the Pope there and maybe the Archbishop of Canterbury, maybe a representative of the Orthodox Church? But no, all Jews. And you say in the video that the Pope was actually specifically excluded from the peace conference.
Right. Yeah, a quote taken from Archbishop Inslee, a Catholic Archbishop of Westminster, actually said the secret pact in 1915 excludes the Pope for deliberations in councils of peace, any councils of peace. So what that basically tells you is that the Masons are hard at work here, because obviously from the video, the previous episodes, we know that, you know, the Catholic Church has been at war for many years with the Masons. And it's got to a point now in World War One, just after World War One, they call the peace conference, and the Pope's excluded because they're not interested in what the Pope has to say. They're Masons.
When did the Pope ever say that he was going to take control of the world? When did the Pope say that he wanted a world government and that him and the Catholics were going to be taking charge of everything? Well, never.
I don't think he did, no. The fact is that the Catholic Church, when they were at the strongest, kept the Jews in the ghettos. And it wasn't until Napoleon came along and let them out that fun and games started with the French Revolution.
Well, this bit with the Pope here, it says that he was excluded as part of a secret pact. Do you know anything about the secret pact, who it was that was involved in this secret pact?
Well, he's obviously talking about the city of London, which is exclusively Jewish. It's certainly a Jewish ram from top to bottom. And they dictate by this time now. We spoke about the Cromwell era. I know they wanted rid of the king because they wanted to seize the financial system. Well, that's a few hundred years now. So by now, 1919, they've already taken the financial system and they're pulling the strings now in Britain. But it's all secret. But it's a secret that some people will realise, even though it is a secret, it's got to be coming from the City of London.
Well, so we've got a secret pact that says that the Pope is not allowed in the Council of Peace or any deliberations in it. Is that any Council of Peace or was this
any? I mean, if they held one-on-one, he just wouldn't be there.
Well, I guess because they made this pact in 1915 and it was 1919, the Versailles Treaty and the Peace Conference. And in 1919, you had a Privy Council of England. Everywhere, we've always had a Privy Council in Britain. I looked up what a Privy Council is. This is what Wikipedia says. It says, Her Majesty's Most Honourable Privy Council, usually known simply as the Privy Council, is a formal body of advisers to the Sovereign of the United Kingdom. Its membership mainly comprises senior politicians who are current or former members of either the House of Commons or the House of Lords. Well, the 1919 Privy Council of England was all Jews. And you list them. We've got Lord Rothschild. Well, most of these are lords, actually. You've got Rothschild, Edward Montagu, Edgar Speer, Matthew Nathan, Alfred Mond, Harry Samuels, Ernest Castle, who was the founder of the London School of Economics, Earl Reading, Rupert Isaacs. They're all Jews. And this is supposed to be the Privy Council of England. This is who advises the monarch, and the monarch then advises the government. And it's all Jews.
That's right. It has been for a while, really.
Yeah, I'd like to know how long that's gone on for. It also says that that there's an oath that they have to take. And, of course, Wikipedia's got this oath under God and all the rest of it. And then it says, people could take a similar oath if they don't want to take a Christian one. And I thought, I bet that's so that these Jews could join. And it was when that oath was changed. Will have been when Jews were able to actually join this council. It's completely subverted. The history of the Privy Council goes back to the Saxons, and the king would have his lords and earls. He'd have them around him, and they could give him advice. That's the tradition of it. And now it's all Jews, banking Jews. So the
advice, and not only in England at that time, but in America as well, and in France.
Yeah, that's it. The Privy Council of all the European nations, or the equivalents of the Privy Council, is all made up of Jews. And that's some pretty damning evidence for our politicians all being puppets, isn't it?
Yeah, England. Well, the English don't control England. That's the gist of that.
And the London School of Economics, I mean, you've always heard that that's a leftist university and a hotbed of Marxism and... Of course, that's why Ernest Castle founded it. It's like George Soros founding that university in Hungary that got banned, that Orban banned this university, didn't he? Because he said it was just turning out communist revolutionaries. He got the same thing here.
They've got these tried and tested ways, I feel. What's an organisation called? What Corbyn belongs to?
The Labour Party.
No, the one that brings out all the communists. I can't think of the name there.
Not Tavistock Group. There's another one with a sheep in wolf's clothing.
Yeah, that's the one. Yeah,
I was just temporarily escaped my mind. Fabians. Fabians.
That's right. It's all Jewish funded. Well, they go a little bit slower than everybody else because that's taken from Fabian, the Roman general who never took a city front on. He'd stay him out or, you know, have them sieges till eventually they surrendered. And this is what the Fabian Society do, go nice and slowly, easing along things. And then suddenly you wake up and you're entrapped in communism.
Yeah, by slow increments, isn't it? They just change things ever so slowly so that the Gentiles don't. So we don't, you know, like the frog and the boiling frog, so we don't notice, and you know, until the goose is cooked,
as it were.
Slowly turn up the heat. Well, 1919, we had the Versailles Peace Conference, and every one of the main leaders took a Jew with them. David Lloyd George, he took a Jew with him, Philip Sassoon. George Clement Cho took Georges Mandel. Woodrow Wilson took Bernard Baruch. And thankfully, your friend who you've used before, well, I say he's your friend, is, you know, he's been quite popular in your series, the Jewish whistleblower, Benjamin Freeman, he was there. So all the top politicians took a Jew along with them. And what we should do, I think, is have a closer look at some of these Jews, Dennis, and see what some of them have been up to. David Lloyd George, we'll start with, and he took Philip Sassoon along with him. And Philip Sassoon married a Rothschild, so he was a Rothschild. And his family was responsible for both the Opium Wars. Do you want to talk a bit about them, Dennis?
Well, basically what it is the Sephardic Jews, I think they originated in Iran, believe it or not, but they were kicked out at some stage and they moved to India, where, you know, they matched up with the Rothschilds and the British. Eventually, I think it was David Sassoon who worked for the, well, didn't work for him, he was a member of the East Indian Company. This East India Company, you know, was owned by Jews in the city of London. And consequently, they went around the world on behalf of the British monarchy trying to make them even richer by certain methods of war. And in the case of China, the Sassoons tried to import opium, which the Chinese obviously refused, and they actually got the British military to help enforce that importation, which, as you said, there was two wars over it, which the Chinese lost both wars. But I suppose by the second war, the country was so drugged up. I mean, I read stories once of how the husbands would sell the wives just to get a fix. It's that addictive. In fact, it's probably the most addictive of them all. And if you try and break the habit, you're facing diarrhea, sickness, all the things that won't help you quit, if you like. And they did this by, there's a few hundred years had gone by where the Jews had actually gone into China, and became part of that, that culture, married into the Chinese. So consequently, he had already, a mass of agents who were, obviously not loyal to the Chinese government.
That's the interesting thing, isn't it? That there were already Jews over there that had interbred with the Chinese, and you couldn't tell them apart from, you know, the way that they looked. I guess they might have had
Chinese, didn't they?
Yeah, well, they might have just been Chinese with sort of beaky noses and strange jowls and maybe like an overhanging lip, but they were still Chinese, so they spoke the language and they did all the work for them. I would question whether there may have been a bit of exaggeration saying that people were prostituting themselves and all the rest of it, because I think that comes down to when drugs are illegal, the price goes up massively. So this was legal. This was like the equivalent of selling alcohol. But you've got a people there, the Chinese, I don't think they'd come across opium before. So a lot of them did become dependent on it, because at the time, I think it was legal. It was legal in Britain. It was legal in Germany. And you didn't have the masses of people falling for it like you did get in China. And the Chinese said, well, we don't want this. we don't want your opium, and you're certainly not going to take it into the interior, because it was just at the time, it was, they said, well, you can sell it on the seafronts, as it were, but you can't actually go right into the interior, just the sea towns. And, Sassoon said, well, you take this, and we want to go into the interior. And they said, well, no, we don't even want this now. So he got the British army to go in there and make war against them. And they ended up with a treaty saying, well, you can come into the interior now, so they could sell it to the whole of China. And that was also how Britain got hold of Hong Kong for 100 years.
Yeah. And he made a fortune
so soon. Yeah, he set up the Hong Kong and Shanghai Banking Corporation, which is, it's like the Bank of England, but over there in that part of the world, we don't really hear of it very much over here. In the Western Hemisphere, in the Eastern Hemisphere, it's huge. And Hong Kong, that's why Hong Kong is a massive banking centre, is because it was all set up by this Philip Sassoon, all off the back of people becoming addicted or dependent on opium. I mean, he was supposed to sell tea to them. But of course, he wasn't very good at that. So he thought, well, it'd be much better if I sell them an addictive substance, and we'll get the opium from India, and he went to Bengal and stopped the Bengali farmers from farming vegetables and said, you've got to farm these poppies for me instead. And I wonder if that didn't have anything to do with the Bengali famine.
Well, there's a surprise.
Yeah. So you've got them producing all these opium poppies, and then you've got all these Bengalis starving of a famine. I wonder if there's a connection.
This opium organization was strictly Jewish. There's no other nationalities or ethnic allowed into it. It was strictly Jewish. And these Jews, these spies, should I say, who were working for Sassoon, they were working under British passports, and the corrupt British monarchy actually honoured them with privileges and knighthood.
Oh, yeah. Made into laws because of all the money they made, I guess. And
unbelievable. Yeah.
They would have been promoted to the people in Britain as in, look at these wonderful, Jewish adventurers that have made so much money for the country without telling us, quite how it was done. And of course, then later on, you've got Sassoon's family, and this Philip Sassoon married a Rothschild. And then you've got the Sassoon with, David Lloyd George. He was best buddies with Anthony Eden, who is also a warmonger, and he was involved in a scandal from having Anthony Eden and Philip Sassoon were actually inside the Houses of Commons having private meetings in Neville Chamberlain's rooms, and yeah, they got away with it. And so here we've got David Lloyd George, the man that he takes to the Versailles Peace Conference. I'm not sure if it was the one responsible for the opium wars.
Steeped in corruption.
Yeah, or his descendant. I mean, what I guess the opium wars, when were they, 1890, something like that?
Yeah, right about then, yeah.
So this probably was the same Philip Sassoon that was involved in those wars.
Could have quite easily,
yeah. Yeah, so you got another warmonger that David Lloyd George is taking to the peace conference.
Churchill was there as well, because he was buzzing around about that time.
Yeah. Yeah, he was involved. Next up, we got the French Prime Minister, Georges Clemenceau. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right. And he brings along someone called Georges Mandel, who is also known as the French Disraeli. But his real name is Jeroboam Rothschild. Alfred Rosenberg that I worked that one out and identified him as really Jeroboam Rothschild. And this guy that was called the French Disraeli, or George Mandel, this Rothschild, was always hand in glove with whatever government was in power in France. It didn't matter if it was on the right, didn't matter if it was on the left. He was the one that pulled the shots. Yeah, he was the one that called the shots. He was also a top Freemason, and he was also a part of the Jewish B'nai B'rith. And finally, he was shot by firing squad in World War II by the National Socialists. What else do you know about George Mandel, Dennis? Have you been looking into him at all?
Well, what surprised me was the fact that, I mean, I'd always known there was one Rothschild died during World War II, but it was surprised to find, because it actually says that in Wikipedia, but it's actually two, because as you quite rightly say, that he was a Rothschild, secretly a Rothschild, and that he was in 1944. Now, you know, whether or not the reason was because he was at Versailles and the Germans knew what Versailles was meant to do, and he was taken to the woods and executed by a German firing squad. So it's two Rothschilds, which again bears this, you know, this myth of Hitler being a Rothschild. Again, doesn't bear well for these people who push that myth.
So you think that was the reason why he was shot?
I think it's a good enough reason, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But I was going to say, because again, this shows that they knew who was responsible for doing this. They knew that it was the Jews that stitched up the Versailles Peace Conference, because, did you know, when Hitler had the armistice with France, he made peace in the carriage with the French, or whoever it was that was offering the peace. He wasn't shooting people.
No.
He was wanting to make peace and saying, look, we'll have it in the same train carriage and the rest of it.
Can I just say, Hitler didn't kill anybody, but the guy who he made the deal with, the shot after the World War II.
Shot him for coming
for
to a deal.
Doing that deal with Hitler.
For doing an armistice.
Yeah, called him a traitor.
The real traitors were the fake governments that were all ran away from their country, left their countries and were hiding out in Britain. They were the traitors. They were the ones that left their countries. They're like the traitors in Syria now, when they say the Free Syrian Army and the Syrian opposition that's in Turkey. They are the traitors. The real government is the one that's there, that's fighting the terrorists. And I think it's the same in World War II. You know, the people were behind the ones that stayed in the country.
Well, I think some governments had been put there previous by the Rothschilds, so they got out for their own sake, because I don't think they would have lasted long if they'd have been captured by the Germans again.
Well, yeah, they're just bankers, weren't they? They were bankers' puppets, and the National Socialists put nationalist governments in power that wanted to do the best for their people. Yeah, yeah, and we've all seen the memes. This is what France was like during the war, and look at what Paris is like now. And you can see the difference, can't you?
No.
Well, the next one.
I'd have never guessed.
The next one we've got is this Elizabeth de Rothschild, who died. Apparently, she died of typhus in the camps. But they say that she was gassed in the camps now, don't they?
Well, she was arrested at first because she tried to cross that line where, you know, the Vichy France, and there was kind of a split in the country where the Germans said they wouldn't, you know, they leave the French alone, but obviously you can't cross this line. And she did try to cross that line, was arrested and put in one of the camps, Raisenbrink or something. Anyway, she died of typhus because obviously, as we know, typhus was rampant throughout that war. And at the end of World War II, they changed the story and said she was gassed. But that then goes against the American findings during the late 1980s, that there was no gassings in any of the German camps in the West.
Well, what if facts have to do with anything, Dennis? They can just make it all up on the spot, can't they?
We know that. That's what they do.
They'll just tell you it's illegal for you to say any different. Was she at the Versailles Peace Conference as well then?
No, she wasn't prior to that, I don't think. In fact, I think she married twice, I think, and the second, her second husband, was the one who instigated her being gassed, I think. But I don't think there was any. I think they might have got divorced before then. I don't think it was, because she was a Catholic, and she reverted back to her original name after the second divorce, I believe.
Right. She's just made it onto my list somehow, but yeah. She wasn't actually at the Versailles Peace Conference. Okay. She must have been in your video. She must have got mentioned in the video for some reason in that point.
Yeah.
Next, we got Woodrow Wilson with Bernard Baruch, and that's a name you probably heard of before. And he apparently made $400 million as chairman of the War Industries Board during the war in America. And this series on Henry Ford's International Jew, there's a lot of information on this Bernard Baruch in there.
And a lot of
yeah, well, a lot of investigations were done. And, you know, what he did, he was just handing out all these contracts to other Jews and saying, oh, no, they're nothing to do with me. They're part of this other bank or whatever. But the fact is that they were Jewish. So all the business contracts that, all the war contracts, the armaments, everything that needed to be made for the war, they were all handed to these Jews. And this Bernard Baruch was skimming off the top of that and getting backhanders from it. $400 million he made out of the war.
Yeah, and there's some say that the war could have been ended 2 years earlier if it weren't for the Jews.
Well, and this is why when the National Socialists came into power, they made it a death penalty for war profiteering, making money out of the war. And that was one of the 25 points, wasn't it?
Yeah, and I covered this guy, Bernard Baruch, recently in the series where he's part of the atomic bomb project when they actually bombed, you know, Japan later on. It all stems from a meeting at the Bohemian Grove, and the Masonic party is called the Brotherhood of Death, and I did quite a bit on that in one of the earlier episodes. But he's one of the main characters.
And there was lots of other Jews there at this peace conference. I mean, this is just some of them. I mean, there's a huge list of them. They were the ones who were, obviously, they're doing all the advising. They'd worked out what it was that they wanted to get out of this before they even went there. And then it was their job to get their Gentile puppet to go along with it. And also, so Benjamin Freeman was there as well, the whistleblower. What do you know about Benjamin Freeman, Dennis?
Well, Benjamin Friedman actually he turned at one point. He was quite a rich person. He did spend quite a lot of money trying to show what the Jews had done at Versailles and why they were doing it. And he actually lived in Germany at the time. And I can remember putting him in one of the episodes in Communism by the Back Door when he actually makes it plain that there was a holy war declared on Germany, and the Germans knew exactly what the situation was. It was Europe was either going to be Christian or it was either going to be Jewish. And this is from one of the Jews at Versailles who was there to see that how Germany was getting ripped apart, and eventually, really, it's a treaty to destroy them.
Well, what was he doing at the conference then? Whose side was he working for? Had he?
Oh, no, he was working for the Jews. I mean, it was quite, as you say, a big contingent of Jews who went over there. And he was kind of a secretary to one of the main ones. And obviously he didn't like what he saw, and exposed him once World War II was over. He went straight to America. And his speech is up on YouTube and kind of, you know, gives an insight to that world which we would never have had.
I've heard some of them. He's a very powerful speaker. I'm just wondering what it was that made him turn on his co-ethnics, what it was that made him decide that he was going to start exposing the Jews, because
he a conscience, to be honest.
Well, he says he's a Catholic, and I'm thinking, was he a Catholic back then at the time of the Versailles Peace Conference, or did that come about sometime later? And once he was a Catholic,
I don't think he would be allowed to if he was a Catholic.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. Maybe he became a Catholic and then decided to expose the Jews, because we do hear of that through history. We hear of, and they become very, almost like crusaders against the Jews, trying to expose the Talmud. There was this guy, Pfefferkorn, at the time of Martin Luther, and he was really intent on getting the Talmud banned and exposing all these parts from the Talmud that were talking about turning Gentiles into slaves and talking about Jesus boiling in hell in vats of excrement and all this sort of stuff. And he was the main one exposing it. And of course, we also hear of Ignatius Loyola, who founded the Jesuits. He was a crypto. So some of these cryptos did try to expose the Jews, and they did very, you know, they seriously tried to be Christians. The majority of the crypto Jews didn't, but some of them did. I mean, we always get the odd exception to the rule that is, you know, is the quote unquote good Jew.
Well, I kind of call him an honourable Jew. There's very few, as we know, only a handful, I think, throughout history. But without their inside knowledge, of which Benjamin Friedman, if people do listen to his speeches, I'm probably going into more detail in this, the following part in this particular episode about him. But he went on to expose, I'm sure, a lot of things that the Jews didn't want to expose him.
Well, he's the one that talks about everything that led up to, everything that added to this anger at what the Jews had done, the way that they corrupted all the arts and the plays and the film. Yeah, and he goes into that, and the first film's promoting adultery and debauchery and all of this, and how it was the Jews that were behind that. And on top of that, you've got them organizing this peace conference that was basically one huge attack on Germany. And I've got some of the details of this Versailles peace conference here, so maybe we can talk about some of them. And again, I've got this from Wikipedia. It says, of the many provisions in the treaty, one of the most important and controversial required Germany to accept the responsibility of Germany and her allies for causing all the loss and damage during the war. And the other members of the Central Powers signed treaties containing similar articles. This article, Article 231, later became known as the War Guilt Clause. The treaty forced Germany to disarm, make substantial territorial concessions, and pay reparations to certain countries that had formed the Entente Powers. In 1921, the total cost of these reparations was assessed at 132 billion marks. That was then $31.4 billion, or £6.6 billion, roughly equivalent to $442 billion today, or £284 billion. And the treaty also stripped Germany of 25,000 square miles, or 65,000 kilometres of territory, and 7 million people. Germany was to cede the output of the Saar coal mines to France and control of the Saar to the League of Nations for 15 years. So that's the industrial heartland of Germany that goes to France. And the treaty, quote unquote, restored the provinces of Alsace-Lorraine to France by rescinding the treaties of Versailles and Frankfurt of 1871. So they're turning over treaties from 50 or 60 years back and giving countries to France that have been German for 60, 70 years. The sovereignty of Schleswig-Holstein was to be resolved by a plebiscite to be held at a future time. In Eastern Europe, Germany was to recognise the independence of Czechoslovakia and cede parts of the province of Upper Silesia. Portions of Upper Silesia were to be ceded to Poland, with the future of the rest of the province to be decided by plebiscite. The province of Posen, now Poznan, which had come under Polish control during the Greater Poland Uprising, was also to be ceded to Poland. Eastern Pomerania, on historical and ethnic grounds, was transferred to Poland so that the new state could have access to the sea and became known as the Polish Corridor. The sovereignty of part of southern East Prussia was to be decided via plebiscite, while the East Prussian sold-out area, which was astride the rail line between Warsaw and Danzig, was again transferred to Poland outright without a plebiscite. An area of 20,000 square miles was granted to Poland at the expense of Germany. Memel was to be ceded to the Allied and Associated Powers for disposal according to their wishes, so whatever they liked to do with that. And Germany was to cede the city of Danzig and its hinterland, including the delta of the Vistula River on the Baltic Sea, for the League of Nations to establish the Free City of Danzig. And finally, Article 119 of the treaty also required Germany to renounce sovereignty over all its former colonies in Africa. And that's just incredible, isn't it? They've just taken whatever it is that they wanted from Germany in country and in people and in industry and set a massive debt of £284 billion to be paid as quickly as possible. And everyone just went along with it. And these Jews worked it all out.
It's an illusion, isn't it? Really, it's a huge rape and plunder, but just done by paperwork. I mean, the League of Nations, for example, was a Jewish invention. The first guy in charge there was Jewish. And it's deceiving in many ways because you get Germany was to see that the output of the Saar coal mines to France and control the Saar to the League of Nations, the Jews, for 15 years. Well, even after 15 years, the people that they put in charge in Germany after this treaty were all Jewish. So it doesn't end after 15 years because the country is run by Jews. So it's an illusion in itself. It's a huge mass plunder and raping, pillaging of Germany done in a polite kind of way presented to the public.
It's just looting them, isn't it? Looting the country at the end of the war. One thing I thought was interesting about this is that they kept saying that things would then be decided by plebiscite. So this is where Germany got the idea from that it's okay to have a plebiscite because it's in this treaty. It says, eventually we'll have a plebiscite and that will decide it. And of course, Germany had a plebiscite. Austria had a plebiscite and decided that it wanted to join Germany. And that was attacked, wasn't it? And they said, Germany has invaded Austria. And again, I think they had a plebiscite in Czechoslovakia, didn't they? And said, well, we want to be part of Germany again, or part of it wanted to go to Germany.
Yeah.
And that was a plebiscite. Yeah. And the precedent set for plebiscites deciding these things was this treaty. Yeah. So there was no way they could argue against it.
Well, their hands were tied, weren't they? I can see it as a big stitch up for some, for whatever reason, the Germans are a threat. And even though they didn't start that war, they took all the blame and took all the punishment as well. Which is really why, people say that the rise of Hitler started at Versailles.
Well, they say eventually, there was no way it could be stopped. There was going to be another war because of this treaty.
Or Germany would die.
And who is it that wants war?
Exactly.
We've got plenty of quotes telling us who it is that wants war and how the Rothschilds want war. And that's how they make their money. But this plebiscite thing, I mean, you've got Crimea today. They held a plebiscite and they decided they want to join Russia. Oh, no, that's illegal. So if the Jews think the plebiscite is going to work in their favour, like they did with the wording of this treaty, that's all fine. But if a country decides that it's going to have a plebiscite anyway, oh, no, that's all illegal. We're going to ignore the results of that.
Mm.
Couldn't be clearer, could it?
Well, it's all trickery, isn't it?
Well, let's have a look at the economy. The German economy was so weak that only a small percentage of reparations was actually paid in hard currency. Nonetheless, even the payment of this small percentage of the original reparations, 132 billion gold marks. Now, don't forget here, 132 billion gold marks. That's gold bullion. That's not just making up fiat currency, is it? That's not just... just writing out how much it's going to be. This is gold bullion that they wanted in reparations. So this small percentage still placed a significant burden on the German economy. Although the causes of the devastating post-war hyperinflation are complex and disputed, Germans blamed the near collapse of their economy on this treaty. And some economists estimated that the reparations accounted for as much as one third of the hyperinflation. And don't forget, what they were asking for is $442 billion worth. So $442 billion worth, or £284 billion worth of gold, is what the Germans were supposed to find to pay for this war and rebuild their country after it had all been destroyed. It's no wonder they ended up with masses of inflation and ended up starving and having to sell their children on the streets. And of course, that's when all these Jews moved into the country with lots of money, buying everything up at, at super cheap prices, wasn't it?
Dirt cheap, yeah. That was the Weimar government. And when Hitler came from Austria and he finally discovered he could see just what was going on, like he said, what really hit him was the fact that he realised that Social Democrats were really communists. He could see it all once it was made plain.
Well, the economists as well, the economist, or the whatever it is, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, the German version of it, he was a Jew. So they had Jews in control of all the banks. So they weren't doing anything to help, the problems that they had with this inflation. It wasn't until Hitler took power and he put, was it Helmut Schacht, something like that, he put in charge of it. And then they started producing their own money, which wasn't based on debt. It was based on the amount of work that, requisitioning works and the amount of work that the population was going to be able to do on labour. They had labour notes. And that was when they were able to bring the economy around and get everybody quite back quickly to work. Yeah, but when they had Jews running the banking system, hyperinflation, it would have destroyed the country.
That's right.
All of this history, people aren't aware, most people aren't aware of, and children certainly aren't taught it. I remember being told.
Not at all, no.
I remember being told, taught at school, in Germany, once Hitler took power, he started just creating his own money and caused massive inflation, and all the Germans had to carry their money around in wheelbarrows.
Yeah.
And the story's the opposite of that, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it's more than that. Like I've always said, that what came out of Germany during the war as well was only what he was allowed to hear. I mean, there was never going to announce, this is a holy war, but we want you 200,000 American Christian soldiers to fight with us against the Christian Germans. They were never going to say that, were they? You know what I mean? So the propaganda comes out that Hitler's a monster, gets all these American soldiers wound up and British soldiers wound up, and in they go into Europe, not to kill the monster, but to kill the actual person who would have prevented what was going on in Europe today. That's the sad part.
Well, what happened with the military as well? Because I know that there were other parts of the treaty. There was a cutback on the military and the army and all of that. What happened there, Dennis?
They weren't allowed a navy. They weren't allowed more than 100,000 in the army. In fact, it got to a point once Hitler was trying to get into power, the SA outnumbered the army, which is why they were the SA taking over.
So this is why you had these groups. This is why you had the SA, the Brown Flags forming.
Right. Because obviously when he's holding his meetings, and obviously they're outnumbered by the communists, so he has to have protection. And these people would get into fights outnumbered with the communists, and this is well documented.
So there was no police and no army to speak of that could protect them.
There's certainly no army. I don't know about police, but even the police would have been run by Jews.
And you see, this is the other thing we don't get taught. Germany was told, well, the reason why we don't want you to have an army and a navy and munitions is because we're all going to stand down right the way across Europe. We're going to cut back on our armaments. We're going to cut back on our armies. We're going to cut back on our military. And nobody else did it. Only Germany is the one that cut back on their military. And Hitler was coming out with suggestions, wasn't he? He was saying, look, why don't we agree not to bomb civilian areas, not to develop certain types of weapons? And he was just laughed at for that, wasn't he?
Well, the thing was that he's left with 100,000 army, and he's got a Bolshevik revolution going on quite close. Obviously, at some stage, they're going to be coming forward. He has to rearm. He's got to rearm. Otherwise, like he said, isn't it? When does a fox ever pass a lamb? We're, taking a chunk.
Well, I recall him giving reasons for why why Germany was rearming or increasing the military. And it was because the Versailles Treaty had been broken by the other countries because they hadn't cut back on their military. Yeah. And he said, this is the final warning. If you don't agree and start cutting back on your military, then I'm going to take it that, that the treaty has been broken by you and that we can increase our military. Now, it may not have been the exact wording as that. It may have been some kind of armament or some kind of tanks, but that was the basic gist of it. That the other countries that were the that were signatures to this treaty had already broken it.
Yeah, that's right.
So, you know, if the treaty's already been broken by the other countries, then he has every right to break it. I think there was a list of ways that the other countries hadn't actually kept up their part of the bargain. It's part of the white paper, all the reasons for why Germany went to war. There was a collection of documents that was prepared that showed all the conversations that went on before Germany went into Poland.
Yeah, that's the other days. I think it's
talking about,
isn't it?
Yeah. It's included in that. And they weren't allowed to use any of that in the Nuremberg trials. They weren't allowed to use any of their defence that they actually had. But it is available online.
That's right. That's people right. Can look it up. I mean, when, you know, when you think about it, at the end of the day, he has to get, you know, a personal bodyguard as well, because apparently, I mean, whether it's true or not, I've yet to verify it, but there's something over 50 attempts to assassinate him, is what it says in Google.
I'm not surprised. And he himself made over 20 attempts at peace during the war. And he wanted disarmament. He didn't want to see war again in Europe. The ones who wanted to see war again in Europe were these Jews behind this conference, the ones that set it up.
That's right, yeah. Obviously, communism itself is international, so that's always going to come, and Hitler would have known that as well.
I mean, just look at how much they took from Germany. It's at the beginning here. 25,000 square miles of territory and 7 million people. 7 million people who were Germans were suddenly told, you're not Germans anymore. You're Polish and you're second rate Polish citizens at that. And we're going to ban you from speaking your language. We're going to ban you from having your own schools. We're going to put massive taxes on you. And this is what they did to the Germans that were in Danzig, but they weren't that well treated elsewhere. And you ended up with all these refugees from Danzig going back to Germany, awful things being done to them, you know, mutilated, beaten up, assassinated. And that was the reason why Germany went into Poland after giving them
what's warnings. Interesting to me, why Poland got so much After World War One, you know, that for some reason Poland seems to have benefited quite sizably.
Maybe that's because of the Jews that were in Poland. Maybe they had more control over Poland than they did over Germany.
Well, it's always had a big Jewish contingent in Poland, that's for sure. It's interesting.
Yeah, I'm not sure of that, but it is quite clear that Poland was the major beneficiary from this.
Yeah, I'm not convinced he just got pulled out of an hat.
And then there was maybe and then there was, you know, it was just setting things up for disputes and arguments and leading on to war,
another world war.
What else are you going to put into this then, Dennis, in the new episode? Is it all going to be to do with the Versailles Treaty, or have you got any ideas for where you're going to move on to from this?
Well, not really, no, because, I mean, I could say something one week and it's totally different next week. But the thing is that it started to develop. I tried doing a little bit last week. Things weren't really happening, so I sat back and eventually when I tried again, things started to develop. When I noticed the Privy Council and I noticed the Versailles thing, I thought, looks like it's an interesting road to go down. So really, I'm going down a road where I don't even know where I'm going to find.
And what you've shown is these Jews that were behind the British Empire and that were controlling the European nations, and how they wanted war, and how they set up this Second World War or else the destruction of Germany. They either just wanted to destroy Germany completely, or they were hoping for another war. Maybe they were, you know, both ways the Jews win, don't they? They make lots of money. Or they kill their enemies, the Germans, the most Christian country in Europe.
Correct. Yeah, absolutely. They're very clever. You know, one thing that, you know, you've got to say that they are very clever. But what really annoys me is the fact that what they hid after World War II and the fact that they had declared a holy war, which you can find on the internet even. And they disguised the fact that it was Christianity, like Benjamin Friedman said, it was Christianity against Judaism. And they hide that fact simply because if they allowed the rest of the world to realize that that was a war that Christianity lost, they'd find it so much more difficult to actually kill Christians and that European Christian culture. Well, because everyone's oblivious to it and they've infiltrated all these religions and churches. And so you've got to a point today where a lot of people just turned away from religion. Makes it so much easier for them to annihilate us.
No, completely. If you've got a strong faith, then we can unite. And we should be learning that lesson all the time. All the time that we see the way that Islam is a united front against us, you know, that should be teaching us that we need to return to our faith so that we can provide a united front against them. You know, if you look at the strength that they have, and they're just non-whites. They've got, you know, what, 80 points average IQ among them. And they're defeating us all the time, beating us all the time at every level because they've got a united front. And we don't. Well, our house is divided.
Well, I was going to say that, you know, the main battle was always with the Roman Catholic Church and Freemasonry, right, which is this war. But since they infiltrated the Catholic Church, I mean, even in England today, I've heard that in some cities in England, the Catholic Church now don't even give confession anymore. So, you know, it's been watered down so much. And then they brought in the Freemasons to infiltrate, and then you get the paedophilia throughout the 60s and now, you know, what's come to light. So people are turning around and looking at the Catholic Church as abhorrent, you know. I do myself, to be honest, when I see, you know, what the leadership's saying today. And so consequently, that main body, you know, the Catholic Church, was defeated, as I showed again in the last episode, in Europe, and helped the National Socialists out of Europe, which has been hidden. A lot of that's been hidden. So consequently, you know, we've got nothing there. I mean, the Pope doesn't even say anything against the New World Order, but goes along with every single word for obvious reasons. And the rest of Christianity is so cut up in other fractions. You know, I mean, you've got these evangelists in America. When I say Christian, I'm not meaning them, but they've hijacked that one because they love Israel. And then you've got, you know, other fractions, which are even weaker since the Catholic Church has been weakened. So consequently, we're heading for a world with no religion, which has been stated by the New World Order. And consequently, we will suffer and consequences, so to speak.
Well, they've done the same to the church that they've done to the government and all the other parts of our society. They've infiltrated it. They've corrupted it. They've weakened it, been like termites, you know, eating into the foundations until the building starts crumbling down around us. They've done it to all our institutions. I mean, one bit I find interesting about this, you've shown the way that they were controlling the British Empire, that they used the British Empire to get these Jews like Sassoon and various others to get them massively rich, to get them all made into lords and knighted. And then they were able to get in with the British government. But then they were able to get in with the governments of these other countries. And then once they'd had this treaty and built up the United Nations, then they no longer needed the British Empire. Then they were quite happy to, you know, just burn the British Empire and get rid of it, which is what happened with World War II. They got Churchill to just destroy the British Empire. It's like, oh, we've had enough of that now. Now we've got world power. Now we've got everyone in our hands. We have no more need for the British Empire. Let's just destroy it.
That's true. Yeah. But I don't think they totally got rid of it. I haven't been able to prove it yet, but I'm not quite convinced that they got rid of it totally. I think it would be a bit like when the wall came down, everybody thought communism had finished, and that was pushed everywhere, where really it wasn't. So it's a little bit like that with the British Empire, but they certainly moved on with military into the American side of it, and they then used the Americans to do the fighting for them.
Well, I think what's happened is that the British part of it has gone. Obviously, the banks are still there, that are still run by the Jews.
The financial
centres, the corporations and the factories, all of that is still being run by the same people. But the British part of it that gave the British people a sense of esteem and a sense of having done some good in the world and having made something of the country, all of that's gone. That's what's gone. The British part of it, it really wasn't British anyway. It was all these Jews doing it. But the self-esteem has gone from that, hasn't it? I mean, they used to have British Empire days.
Kids used to... self-esteem. They're wiping us out.
Well, I mean, they used to have, like, British Empire days and all the kids would have to go to school dressed up as if, you know, they were Indian or Chinese or whatever. Yeah, they call it racist now. But, you know, it was great for the British people to have that sense of esteem. You know, we had this big empire and it was built by the British spirit. We've colonized America as well. I mean, at least we can still say we colonized America. But there's a huge sense of self-esteem to have this big empire. And that's why Adolf Hitler admired the English for that empire.
They were great fighters. Great soldiers, you know, tough working class, you know, coming from tough working class areas, these people. And, you know, they were sent abroad, unaware, obviously, that they were fighting for the Jews, but, you know, just like today. And so, you know, you did get a certain admiration of it all. I mean, a lot of things went on which the British public never, which I've also revealed, didn't know what was going on. It was not typically British at all, but typically Jewish. But they never, Britain never actually benefited in any way financially. It all went to the elite and it all went to the Jews who were marrying into the elite. So consequently, you have a split nation. But like you say, after World War II, didn't feel the need for the British military anymore. They moved to, onto America, which they controlled anyway, and used their military and a fake Cold War to throw in.
I think you also had, the British weren't known for being fair. And, you know, if we had trials, you know, people would get a fair hearing at a trial. And we were known for not just letting the natives kill one another. We would step in and try and protect them, you know, and provide law and order so that they weren't all killing one another. All of that has gone.
It's long gone.
Do you know what I mean? When you feel you've got, you know, big boots to fill and it's expected of you to act in an honourable way and a trustworthy way, none of that's there anymore.
At some stage, it could well be in this episode, I'm going to swing over to the people what could see it, like John Amory could see it, you know, and other nationalists in Britain could see what was happening, but were drowned out because the Jews were just too powerful. They already controlled the media in Britain. And so when, you know, you got the likes of John Amory saying, look, you know, I'm not going to fight for communism and the Jews, went abroad to fight for Germany, because he knew the situation. He knew exactly what was happening. And there were one or two people, I think it was the Riot Club over here, I looked into a couple of weeks ago, and they were kind of nationalists who were trying to stop this war with Germany, failed, and then they tried to, in some way, get a negotiated peace, but they were all jailed.
Well, I'll tell you what would be good, to do something on the objectors, because you've also got Oswald Mosley, you've got all the people that were locked up under Regulation 18B. I mean, there was a massive movement that was against the war. You know, there's a whole story there that hasn't been told that would probably make for a very good 15-minute mini-documentary all in itself.
It is an issue that a lot of people don't know about, and they looked on as traitors anyway.
Yeah, that would definitely be a good one to do. Anyway, we've reached the end of the podcast, Dennis.
So,
thank you very much for coming on once again. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. Don't forget, we do require donations to keep the radio station going. You can find that in the sidebar. You can donate to our Bitcoin wallet if you can afford to. Thank you very much for listening. Hope you all have a great weekend, and we'll see you all again next Friday at the same time.